Thanks very much. My paper's called The World According to the Efficient Markets Hypothesis, Radically Conservative, Socially Empty, Financially Unstable. And I want to start with two anecdotes, and apologies in advance if these come across as being in any way overly personal. The first anecdote is this. It's not often that I find myself trying to locate Paul Krugman on the side of the angels, but Eugene Farmer of Efficient Markets Hypothesis fame managed to do this for me in 2009. He had an online dispute with Krugman over the nature of Obama's stimulus package. Farmer blogged very stridently about all the poor businesses that were closed or that would never get to open in the first place because they were being crowded out by public investment in the economy. Every dollar of the stimulus package, he said, represented one lost dollar from the private economy. Now, it's usual for economists to hide behind the as-if methodology to say when pressed that, of course, they don't think that their theories are literal representations of the world that they live in. But here was Farmer, however, giving a much more exaggerated account of the efficient markets hypothesis than even his own work on the subject would allow. What happened next? Krugman bemoaned the consequent return to the dark ages for macroeconomics. Meanwhile, Farmer, wouldn't we just know it, got a Nobel Prize. My second anecdote is definitely a personal one. Over the last few weeks, I've found myself casting my mind back to a paper that I wrote more than 10 years ago now, noting that the FTSE 100 index had lost more than half of its value in 3 years after the tech stock crash. Without this ever really coming to any sort of public attention at all. It was a market crash of a gigantic scale, but without any public conversation at all. The other newsworthy factor at the time, of course, was just how high the housing market was riding. So the blowing of one bubble was able to cancel out the collapse of another. Just compare this with the situation we're in today, though. We're still living through the restructuring of the economy in the wake of the financial crisis. We see evidence of increased joblessness, of people when they stay in jobs being forced to work harder for less money. For those of the in-work poor who now need to rely on benefits just to make ends meet, their access to those benefits is becoming increasingly difficult. But what's going on within financial markets? Well, average house prices have now gone past their prior 2007 all-time historical peak, while the FTSE 100 index is roaring away and looks sure to push past its prior 1999 all-time historical peak within the next few weeks. This, of course, will all be lauded politically by the government as evidence of its own courage in the face of all of the naysayers to push on bravely with its expansionary austerity policy. But what it means really is that we'll be back, and with a vengeance, in double bubble territory. So what have these two anecdotes got to do with the efficient markets hypothesis and therefore with the contents of my paper this morning? Well, the first shows something very interesting, I think. It shows how difficult it is for the higher echelons of the economics profession to think beyond the implications of their own models, even when alternative, contradictory evidence even is available. It becomes very difficult for them to voice opinions which go against their own professional training. It reminds me of a famous riposte by Keynes, who was once accused that he changed his mind, to which he replied, "Well, when the facts change, I do change my mind. What do you do?" Well, in this instance, I think we see that the higher echelons of the economics profession have not changed their mind over the last few years, and if anything, they plug their own arguments even more stridently than before. The second anecdote shows what these supposedly efficient markets actually do. We're apparently living through an age where the political classes have such a high regard for keeping finance in check. It doesn't look from these price developments as if finance is being kept in check. To me, it looks as though finance is running free and wild and prices are going up along the way. So that's where I start with this paper. It's derived from my recently published book, which is called Uneconomic Economics and the Crisis of the Model World, which seeks to explore the connections between these two themes in rather greater detail. There I ask not only why the financial crisis has not led to a more deep-seated questioning of the market-conforming models that dominate economics, but also how the re-narration of the crisis how it's moved from being a crisis of finance to a crisis of an overextended state has helped to restore the social authority of orthodox economics opinion. It was possible to question market conforming models in the immediate outburst of the crisis, because we know that so much of the financial instruments that had imploded were first the products of the blackboard economics of the orthodox tradition. But as soon as the whole focus of the crisis shifted, not from how to get finance back in a box, but to how to stop the state from spending too much, orthodox economists rode to the rescue with their pre-worked out models of why government spending is always to be treated very, very carefully. So we've seen a rejuvenation of orthodox economics through austerity, one of the aspects of the crisis that I'm not sure has got the attention that it probably deserves. The underlying problem, I suggest, is one of the increasing embrace of what I've called uneconomic economics. Uneconomic economics results from a significant shift in the orthodox practices of economists. There was a time when economics was largely aligned behind the perceived need to understand the historical dynamics that led at one time or another to either functional or dysfunctional market arrangements. The objective was always to try to identify verifiable patterns of economic socialization, which allowed markets to form in distinctive ways. In turn, these served as the fulcrum of the underlying form of everyday economic relations. So economic, in that sense, always meant the type of economy that you could experience in your everyday life. Instead, now, though, the focus is primarily on trying to specify ideal market conditions read off from the logical implications of the behavioural axiom of rationality. And since Samuelson, moreover, this is rationality that's stripped of all sorts of motive. That people act rationally, but they don't know why they're acting rationally or what they're acting rationally in advance of. This was Samuelson's move to try to rid economics of both psychology and sociology. And so that's the type of market models that we now have. No attempt is generally made to match the postulated logical relationships with observed economic socialization, and as such, the resulting accounts of economic life are fundamentally uneconomic in nature. The economic essence of economics is increasingly being replaced by an aesthetic essence, where the argument is condensed into the purity of the form in which it's made, rather than the realism of the type of economic experiences that it posits. So this is the big shift for me, a shift from economic economics to uneconomic economics. And the efficient markets hypothesis is an important part of this shift. It's important in all sorts of different ways. I think it acts as calling card, as ingrained common sense, as instinctive assertion, as axiomatic assumption, as visualization technique, and probably most importantly, as professional vindication. If you can announce yourself as an efficient markets economist, your stock as an economist is likely to rise. So what does it say? Well, it suggests that market prices are always efficient in the sense that they've incorporated all known information that might influence their one true value. Or in stronger versions, all information that might possibly be known both now and in the future. That apparently market prices, if they're to be truly efficient, have to incorporate all of those things. The headline result of this style of argument, I think, really comes in its translation, from blackboard economics into political action, because it suggests that it's never possible to preempt, second guess, or beat the market, because no individual can ever have more price-relevant information than the market environment itself can embed. The mathematician John Lytton Synge has a description for resulting effects of this nature. He refers to them as the Pygmalion syndrome, after the sculptor in a story by Ovid. Apparently, I wasn't classically schooled, so I don't really know. I have to take his word for it on things like this. But apparently, the goddess Venus brought one of Pygmalion's statues to life, not only because, Nicky's nodding, he obviously was classically schooled, not only because its intrinsic artistic beauty had made him fall in love with it, but also because it encouraged others to treat it as if it was real. And Synge worries about the capacity for theorists of all sorts to treat their theories as if they are real, as if they act on assumptions that are embedded within reality. Now, the aesthetic appeal of the best mathematical models of the market world should not be in doubt. I think there is a parallel there with Pygmalion's statue, that the mathematical capacity that's built into these models is truly awe-inspiring in the literal sense of that word. But this, of course, doesn't make them real in any other specific sense. But as long as enough economists place their faith in them, then they begin to take on the aura of reality in public debate. We should never underestimate just how significant economists are to driving public debate about the economy, even if they want to place a distance between themselves and the old-fashioned public intellectual's role. The vernacular description of the model's main findings is what's important. So a translation effect is in evidence, whereby purely abstract economic relationships that come from blackboard economics take on an altogether different form when they re-emerge in everyday language of the economy and everyday language of economic possibilities. This, I think, is probably the most important effect of the efficient markets hypothesis. I could sit here till I'm blue in the face saying it's wrong on all sorts of levels, but that doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter whether it's wrong empirically. It matters how it can be used in political translation and how that political translation can affect the realm of the possible. In this case, the most direct translation comes from the fact, supposed fact, that all policy action that impedes market outcomes is necessarily self-defeating. However well-intentioned it is, this does not matter. It's ineffective to the point of being counterproductive to intervene within markets. That's the view from the efficient markets hypothesis. This is also often enough on its own, I think, to blur the dividing lines between two different types of market relationship. There is the abstract markets, probably in inverted commas, that belong to the blackboard world of economics. And it's so often the case now that the relationships that hold there are misunderstood as also being relationships that might belong to the real world. So once more, there's this translation effect going on, a translation that probably is a mistranslation and certainly a translation that allows misidentification of purely logical, purely abstract relationships to be treated as if they are relationships that belong to the real world. And the fact that markets, in this sense, can still be spoken about in reverential tones, if the market says that this is the true price, then it must be so, I think that often obscures the capacity to challenge politically the translations that come from the efficient markets hypothesis. But how have we got to this position in the first place? After all, early preemptions of the efficient markets hypothesis were deemed heretical. They were criticized for economists imperialistically colonizing another area of social relations with their increasingly uneconomic mode of thought. Finance theory prior to the 1950s, well, its center of gravity in any case, had been completely separate from economics, being based, ironically, on the much more economically relevant basis of learning about the market environment and understanding it as an institutionalized set of human relations. The forward march of economics into finance, however, presented opportunities instead for an increasingly uneconomic view of the way that financial prices form and financial markets work. The efficient markets hypothesis, to quote the conference theme, was initially the work of intellectual rebels from economics taking over another aspect of social knowledge that had seemed to be originally outside of their specialist purview. Now, my critique of it, at least as far as the title of my paper goes, is threefold. I want to argue, firstly, that it's radically conservative, secondly, that it's socially empty, and thirdly, that it's financially unstable. I suspect I probably have no more than about a minute for each of these three aspects of the critique. So let me start very quickly with the radically conservative aspect. Well, for people of my generation or younger learning economics, I think the idea that market models ruled the roost was taken pretty much for granted. This is what we were taught as economics, full stop. Not just as a particular form of economics, but this was economics. However, if we begin to just scratch the surface, even momentarily, of the history of economic thought, this shows that this has not always been the case. The efficient markets proponents were historically, it bears repeating, always the heretics. They were always the people who the others working in the field found most objectionable intellectually. Economics, therefore, has taken on a radically conservative character under the influence of the efficient markets hypothesis that it only very seldomly had before. As the farmer anecdote with which I began demonstrates, though, the degree of political conservatism built into the visualization technique on which the efficient markets hypothesis is based now knows pretty much no bounds whatsoever. Even in the depths of the most serious economic recession since the 1930s, a Nobel Prize-winning economist could say, hand on heart, all seriousness, that any intervention by the government to try to kickstart economic activity was at best going to be neutralised by the effects that this would have on the private sector, and at worst would be positively counterproductive. This is the expansionary austerity thesis on steroids, and it never goes away, because there are always enough politicians that want to believe this sort of stuff if economists provide them with a reason for believing it in the first place. Secondly, the underlying problem here, I think, is one of basic composition. What do markets actually look like in the efficient markets tradition? Well, they certainly don't look anything like anything that approaches what we might actually experience in our everyday experiences of operating within markets, because there are no real people in the market clearing models of the efficient markets tradition, because to allow them to appear there always runs the risk of corrupting the pristine nature of the models. Indeed, since the path-breaking work in the 1970s of Sonnenschein, Mantell and De Bruijn, economists have known that it's not possible using any agential restriction whatsoever to scale up rational individual preferences of one person into the production of market-clearing dynamics on the demand side. There is no basis on which you can make that move. Economists know this, and so they've tried to fix the problem by assuming that there's only one person in each market, or at the very least, that a representative individual substitutes for the great plethora of different opinions on how to go about living everyday economic life. The efficient markets tradition goes one stage further, though, and doesn't even talk about a representative individual at all. It's the market itself that makes all the decisions in this tradition. Clearly, that's nonsensical in any empirical sense, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because the translation effect into the politics of the efficient markets hypothesis is the all-important thing. Finally, in conclusion, now it'd be one thing if all this led to financial markets that made good on their proponents' promises. As we know, though, they might enrich a chosen few in the name of enhanced efficiency, but what do the rest of us really feel we're getting out of them? Nothing but increasing doses, I would argue, of more financial instability. The objective within financial markets is still to hide behind the facade created by the efficient markets tradition to go all out in full-scale pursuit of self-enrichment. This is not the basis for stability at all. Nothing else matters. No thought is given to presumed public good effects of enhanced efficiencies, and very little care is expressed for those people who suffer along the way. The efficient markets hypothesis, final word, is a distraction. It's a distraction from what's actually going on in financial markets, and hopefully we'll hear from the two Chrises some other stories about what's going on within actual financial markets. However, it's an exceptionally important distraction. It's an exceptionally important distraction because it's embedded in the common sense of both political elites and the economists they use as their advisors. It's also visible in the everyday language of markets that I suspect that all of us use to plot our way through everyday life, and I suspect that all of us use that language in some way without being aware that we're doing so. Thank you.